Welcome to Two-Way Street. I'm Bill Nigut. Today's show was inspired by a chance meeting my wife Janice Schaefer and I had at a party in Decatur a while back. Many of the guests were academics, primarily from Emory University. We struck up a conversation with Dennis Gainty, who we learned is an associate professor of history at Georgia State University. When Dennis told us he was in the process of writing a book about bluegrass music in Japan, and when he described the wild enthusiasm many Japanese have for bluegrass, Janice said, "This is a guest you have to have on Two-Way Street." She was right. And so Dennis Gainty joins us today to talk about how this music that seems so deeply embedded in Americans' origins has found an audience 7,000 miles and a wide ocean away. So, Dennis, welcome to Two-Way Street. I'm really glad you could be here to talk about bluegrass.
I am really glad to be here as well. This is a real treat. Thank you.
Your expertise is in Japanese bluegrass, but I think it's really important that we go back and talk a little bit about bluegrass here in the United States. And if I can, here's my starting point. I think one of the most important moments in the history of bluegrass came when Bill Monroe, in 1945, brought Earl Scruggs, the great banjo player, together with Bill Monroe's group, the Bluegrass Boys, and they all played the Ryman Auditorium, the Grand Ole Opry, on a night in 1945, right?
That's right. That's right. And that pairing is what a lot of people point to as being kind of the beginning of the bluegrass sound as we know it. Now, this is a little bit tricky because bluegrass doesn't really become identified as a genre until maybe the late 40s, maybe even the 50s. And it was named, of course, after Bill Monroe's group.
Dennis, let's listen to what I think looks like it was a Backstage of the Opry TV show done quite a few years after that night in 1945 that Bill Monroe and Earl Scruggs teamed up for the first time.
Friends, that Bill Monroe brought the bluegrass sound with him when he came to the Grand Ole Opry. Is that right?
You're right, good.
Now, we've heard some great compliments on the job that you and your boys did at the Newport Folk Music Festival. Must have been an exciting experience.
Oh, it was. Really wonderful.
Boy, you're a talkative one, Bill.
I know.
As a solemn old judge, George D. Hay used to say, here's Bill Monroe and the Bluegrass Boys. Let her go, boys.
Come from far away, the dance all night till the break of day. When they called her a hollering, do-si-do, you knew Uncle Finn was ready to go.
Hey, you need any about some down, how the hill is above the town. Play a little lot of how to bring, you can hear it talk, you can hear it sing.
That's wow. A great tune.
It's
what
a
lovely tune.
It's a great song. There are a couple of fascinating threads. The old judge, George D. Hay, by the way, was actually 30 years old when he was first announcing the Opry on the radio.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, there's a lot of really clever stuff that they're referencing there. The song is actually about Bill Monroe's own Uncle Penn.
Didn't
who is
know
the
that.
Inspiration. Right. And this is a real historical figure who's become almost kind of beatified by the bluegrass community. And I have friends in Japan who presented me with a sliver of Uncle Penn's cabin that they'd acquired, and they had a little certificate to prove it as well. So I've got that at home.
The Opry had been going on for quite a long time. It had been going on since the mid-20s, actually, at WSM Radio. It was actually a show that was kind of put together by an insurance
company. That's right.
Company.
We Serve Millions.
We Serve Millions, which is where they got the WSM in the Nashville radio station's name.
The story about bluegrass, of course, that we like to tell ourselves and that feels really true and important is that Bill Monroe did create it and introduced it as bluegrass and as the people's music. But just as you said, when we're thinking about the kind of technologies that went into producing this music, that's supposed to be this very rural, very pure, acoustic, white, Protestant,
Southern,
Southeastern, in fact, not just Southern, but very much of the Appalachians, right? So this is mountain music of a certain kind of people. That sort of image is really carefully cultivated by Monroe when he's putting this kind of thing together. And you can even see in the outfits that he's wearing, the rather than overalls, these kind of jodhpurs and country gentlemen sort of suits and ties. So he's very careful to say this is a people's music, but please understand, we're not poor people. We're people to be taken seriously.
You know, it's interesting you say that because I found a video that we'll post on the Two Way Street website and Facebook page of Bill Monroe and Earl Scruggs and all the other performers who are going to be at the Opry on a given night backstage in one of the dressing rooms. And they sing a song as they're preparing to go out and play the Opry. And Bill Monroe and Earl Scruggs are wearing white shirts, ties, and suits. They might as well be business leaders in the community.
That's right. That's right. They were very deliberate about that, in fact, because they knew that there was this kind of hayseed, overall-wearing, hillbilly image, and they were working very hard to go against that. Now, the thing, too, that's important to understand about the 1945 appearance with Earl Scruggs and, of course, Lester Flatt, the guitar player who was always with Earl Scruggs, and they formed a really important duo, when they split off from the Bluegrass Boys and achieved quite a lot of fame, not least because they performed the theme song of the Beverly Hillbillies. They were then known as a bluegrass act, and this made Bill Monroe just mad as can be. He felt that they were appropriating his name, and he felt initially that calling the genre bluegrass was somehow taking something away from him.
He owned it. As far as he was concerned.
As far as he was concerned, bluegrass meant the Bluegrass Boys.
We're going to listen to a little bit of Flatt and Scruggs, as a matter of fact, because Flatt and Scruggs were, of course, one of the great acts in country music, bluegrass music, however you want to say it.
That's right.
I thought I had seen pretty girls in my time. That was before I met you. I never saw one that I loved it. That was before I met you. I thought I was swinging the world by the tail. I thought I could never be blue. I thought I'd been kissed and I thought I'd been loved. But that was before I met you.
You point out that, in fact, the notion of bluegrass music in Japan is in some ways no stranger than the fact that this music, as you say, of white, southern, southeastern, Christian hill folks becoming adopted by Americans in the Northeast, in Boston, in New York, right? That to you is a cross-cultural experience too.
That's absolutely right. And I think that's such an important part of a lot of what I've been finding out about how bluegrass music is operating in Japan and kind of what this larger story tells us. Because we have this notion that bluegrass is very much American and is very traditional. And that, along with the idea of its white, Christian, Southeastern, not just Christian, but Protestant and rural roots, already has caused us not to pay attention to the African-American influences. And Bill Monroe learned a lot from an African-American musician named Arnold Schultz. Clearly, there's a lot of influence of blues and of jazz in there. But we still don't really pay that much attention to it. We kind of think of it as a sort of white music. And that's to say nothing of the Polynesian influences.
Polynesian?
Absolutely. Hawaiian music was such a craze in the 1910s and 20s in the United States. And all of, if you ever hear a slide on a guitar, that's straight out of Hawaii.
What is the difference between bluegrass and country music, Dennis?
Well, typically, bluegrass, and this is a very dangerous kind of question, but generally speaking, when we think about bluegrass, we're thinking about a set kind of acoustic instrumentation, not electric, and something that, although it was produced in Nashville, ended up finding its way into other markets. And so in some ways, it's kind of a commercial difference that split off in the 50s and 60s, when country music was envisioned as a way to kind of compete with rock and roll. But that kind of dials back before bluegrass and before country, when we might call that music hillbilly or mountain music or country and western. And back when it was country and western, it seemed like it did encompass a lot of those hillbilly sort of antecedents that then become bluegrass.
Let's leave American bluegrass music behind for a moment, because we are going to talk about Japan and bluegrass music. So let's go back in history to talk about something that I'm fascinated by that you point out in one of the articles you've written on all this. Who introduced the American banjo to the Japanese people?
Well, that would be Commodore Matthew Perry, the naval officer in 1853, who led a fleet, a very small fleet, of the so-called black ships, the most technologically advanced warships of the day that the United States could muster, these steamships. And they came to Japan in order to open it initially as a way station for American vessels, which needed to refuel or replenish their supplies when they were on whaling or other expeditions. But very quickly, this kind of launched into the kind of unequal treaties that Britain and other countries had used against China. And this was a way for these Western powers to manipulate and really kind of take control of these.
Yeah, and we don't want to overlook the importance of Perry's first contact with the Japanese. At that point, Japan was an island kingdom isolated from the rest of the world, operating on laws and traditions that were centuries and centuries old. They were protected against Western influence entirely. And when Perry's fleet sailed into the harbor, it changed everything.
It's a really dramatic moment. And of course, Japanese historians will say, well, they weren't really so isolated. They actually had, through very limited contact with the Dutch off of Nagasaki, a very good sense of what was going on in Europe, although, of course, filtered through the Dutch. And the Dutch were giving them their own sense of what was going
on. Right. Okay.
And they had a good sense of European science and European anatomy and a lot of different advancements that were going on. And they traded through these proxies with other countries. But by and large, they were very... they had a kind of splendid isolation.
Yeah, and the Dutch really didn't change, put its their imprint on the culture of Japan the way America did after Perry landed.
That's absolutely true. That was a real shock. And leading up to Perry's visit, of course, Russian warships and British ships had been appearing on the horizon, and Japan had become increasingly nervous and thinking, what are we going to do with these white people that are showing up in ever greater numbers? But when Perry comes and makes his definite demands, that's just it.
In what way did he introduce the banjo to the Japanese people?
So this is great because Perry is thought of as being this really important figure with diplomatic or military history. But one thing that's often overlooked is that in an effort to kind of impress and engage with the Japanese on the shore, among other things, he's got like this tiny one-quarter scale steam locomotive that he sets up and impresses them with technology. But he also has his own sailors come off the ship, and they get up in blackface and do a minstrel show, including, of course, banjos. And so all of the crazy layers of American culture, the sort of thoughtless racism and the appropriation not just of African instruments like the banjo, which used to be the banza or the banjar or the banji or all these other things, but also the attitudes of Americans towards Africans at the time. It's just an amazing moment. And by all accounts, the Japanese are just delighted by this. They've never seen anything so funny and entertaining as these white sailors blacking up in order to play these minstrel songs for them.
It kind of makes your head spin to imagine a court in 19th century Japan with perhaps a warlord or other ruler and his entourage listening to American sailors in blackface playing banjos and singing minstrel songs.
That's exactly right. It's fantastic, you know? And the funny thing is, too, my Japanese friends in the bluegrass community there are so charmed by this story. And they always, always make a point of saying, you know, there have been banjos in Japan as long as there have been Americans.
My guest today is Dennis Gainty. He's an associate professor of history at Georgia State University. We're talking about how bluegrass, a music deeply rooted in the history of the people of the Appalachian Mountains, has crossed the Pacific Ocean and been embraced by the Japanese. We'll take a break now, and in a moment we'll continue our conversation and play music of some of the great Japanese bluegrass bands that Dennis has been following.
Around.
Welcome back to Two-Way Street. I'm Bill Nygut. Let's get back to our conversation now with Georgia State University Professor of History, Dennis Gainty. He's an expert on how that most American music, bluegrass, has been enthusiastically embraced in Japan, of all places. So now we're going to take a big jump ahead in time. Let's talk about the years right around the start of World War II. The Japanese were introduced in a much more direct way, you point out, to bluegrass music on what, Armed Forces Radio?
That's right. And in fact, during the war, of course, under the Japanese government, the very militaristic, imperialistic Japanese government, Western music from England and the United States was absolutely a no-go. So all of the jazz...
They were listening to German
They were listening radio. To German music, yeah. Sure enough, and they were listening to Italian music. And actually not radio at this point. They just had recordings of it because radio wasn't coming that far, right? But gradually, as the U.S. forces are making their way through this really terrible island-hopping campaign through the Pacific towards Japan, they would, when they occupied an island, set up what was called the mosquito network. And somebody would just shinny his way up the tallest palm tree and place a little 50-watt transmitter. And these transmitters were used, of course, to communicate among the armed forces, but they were also used for entertainment. So as American forces are moving through the Pacific in the Solomon Islands or elsewhere, you have people listening to recordings of the Grand Ole Opry, or even indigenous groups, Solomon Islanders, playing on their own instruments and singing Home on the Range and She'll Be Coming Round the Mountain. It was a really crazy time of this kind of unintended cultural imprint, because a lot of these GIs, of course, were from these rural southern backgrounds at the time, and so they were just interested in hearing music from back home, and that meant the sort of precursor to bluegrass is hillbilly music. But the idea that there was, that this was even kind of the theme of their broadcast, right? That they would have indigenous groups playing Carter family hits from the southeastern part of the United States in this Pacific theater is just such a weird melding of cultures.
That really is the beginning of a movement in which the Japanese people start having a real interest in bluegrass, yes?
That's right. And at the time, of course, despite the best efforts of the Japanese government, there were Japanese citizens who knew about bluegrass, or again, the kind of antecedent to bluegrass, this hillbilly music or country and western music. They had heard it in records from before the war. They kept those records. And actually, a couple of performers who are really important in the early history of Japanese bluegrass, the Ozaki brothers, they were listening to these recordings in secret and then even made themselves instruments out of cigar boxes and shamisen strings, these Japanese instrument strings. And apparently they just sounded awful, but they would hole up in closets together and try to learn and perform these songs for one another.
You mentioned the Ozaki brothers, who have another, what's their, do they have a name beyond the?
They do. In the late 1950s, I'm sorry, they founded what some folks refer to as the first Japanese bluegrass band, the East Mountain Boys.
We're going to listen to a little excerpt of the East Mountain Boys singing and playing Columbus Stockade Blues, which is a Georgia song, right?
That's exactly right. It's about Columbus, Georgia, about the stockade that was down there.
Let's listen. Mountain Boys singing about Columbus, Georgia. I didn't hear enough of it to hear how they're singing about Columbus. What are they saying in the lyrics?
Way down in Columbus, Georgia, want to be back in Tennessee. Way down in Columbus, Georgia.
The star came, my friend, and the girls were so keen.
But the idea is that this person trapped in the stockade in Columbus, Georgia, wishing that he were back in Tennessee and knowing that the woman that he loved has left him for somebody else because he's in the pokey.
So how would the Ozaki brothers have come across a song like that, do you imagine?
There were hillbilly records available in Japan, in the 1930s, yeah. Although they were few and far between. And it was called, I think, in the catalogs then, hilly billy music.
When did you first start hearing Japanese bluegrass music?
So in 1993, I quit my job as a geologist in order to go teach English in Japan because it sounded like a neat thing to do. And I really didn't know much Japanese language, and I I knew none, and I was kind of adrift there. And there was a local pub that I went to from time to time. And one night I went into the pub, and there was this full five-piece bluegrass band of Japanese guys in their 40s and 50s, and they were just monstrous pickers. And even beyond that, they were singing in just the purest, best Appalachian accents. Everything was just spot on. And I had already started playing a little bit of mandolin, and I really liked bluegrass music, although I didn't really understand it very well, having grown up in Massachusetts and not really being that plugged into the community. So I went up to them afterwards and said, "Hey, I just love this music. This is great. It kind of reminds me of being back home. Where did you learn this?" And they said, "Ah, ちょっとすみませんが英語がわからないんですね." Which means, "Oh, I'm sorry, I don't speak English." And I thought, what the heck? How is it possible? What's going on here, you know?
They're singing American songs.
Beautifully.
Well, you do say in one of the articles that you've written, little discontinuities creep in. The stereotypical but real swapping of R's and L's, the odd shaping of vowels, the occasional phonetically learned non-sec lyric. These are all the more striking because most singers in Japanese bluegrass seem expert at producing the classic high, lonesome sound.
That's right.
So you did hear your more American-trained ear. You do hear these odd moments.
Absolutely. Sometimes you do. Now, that first time, I was just so blown away. I thought, my goodness, that's perfect. But it's true. After a while, if you start listening, of course, and especially folks who have learned these lyrics phonetically, you can tell that there's something that's not quite right. And every once in a while, it's kind of glaring and wonderful that somebody will sing about lolling in my sweet baby's arms.
You sent us a clip of a Japanese bluegrass group covering Paul Simon's song.
That's right. That's
tell
right.
us about this.
This is the group Bluegrass 45, and they were perhaps the most important kind of second wave bluegrass group. These are young guys in the late 60s and early 70s in Kobe, Japan, which is a really important port city and has a lot of international influence. And there, not only were they kind of hearing this music, but they were hearing it in the context of essentially sort of this global countercultural moment.
When you're weary, feeling small, when tears are in your eyes, I'll dry them all. I'm on your side. Oh, when times get rough, and princess king.
I love that. What I love, especially, Dennis, is that in the instrumental introduction, you have no idea what you're about to. You might as well be listening. You might as well be in Nashville listening
to a band. That's absolutely right. That's right.
And then they start singing, and it's pretty clear that there is an effort going into shaping the vowels to singing as closely as they can to the American.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And this is clearly kind of, I mean, it's important to understand, too, almost none of these guys is a professional. I think, in fact, I'm going to be a little off, but I can think of maybe two, possibly three actual professional Japanese bluegrass musicians in Japan
really?
Who are making a living being bluegrass musicians.
Well, but is Bluegrass 45 one of them, you said?
No, in fact, these guys, even though Bluegrass 45 was really important, they were seminal in the development of Japanese bluegrass. They're the guys, these two brothers, Watanabe Toshio and Inoue Saburo, they're the guys who set up the world's third longest running, continuously operating bluegrass festival in Takarazuka.
So that Bill Monroe's is number one.
That's right.
There's a festival in Oklahoma City, I think, that's number two or in Oklahoma, right?
You know what? I can't.
I think so.
Yeah, I think that sounds right.
Yeah, I think that's right. Okay, but you know what? So maybe in a way we did them a slight discredit by playing a song that American ears would hear isn't quite working the way if it's...
Well, go ahead. Actually, I mean, you disagree. I would disagree a little with that because I think the thinking of it as not quite being exactly perfect English is certainly a reasonable standard, right? Because they're singing a bluegrass song and they're singing in English lyrics. But if you sort of flip it and think that these guys are not necessarily making money doing it and that they have other things in their lives going on, and for whatever reason, they've reached out in order to try as best they can through this labor of love to reproduce it.
Well, what I appreciate about them is it occurred to them to take a standard song like Bridge Over Troubled Waters and make it a bluegrass song. I think that in itself is sort of ingenious.
I absolutely agree. There's another cut that I don't know if we're going to get to.
Yeah, I was just going to say, why don't we hear them play something else to get a better sense of just how good this group can be? This is, again, Bluegrass 45. They're playing a festival in North Carolina somewhere, I think.
That's right. That was one of Carlton Haney's festivals, I believe.
Probably the group that's, absolutely the group that's come the farthest this weekend to be with us, have come all the way from a different continent, 10,000 miles to be here this weekend. And they've set a tremendous record wherever they've gone this summer. Crowds love them because they can pick and sing and come up with original material and arrangements. And they have a great feel for bluegrass music and working the stage. If you haven't seen them before, get together now and welcome from Kobe, Japan, the Bluegrass 45.
Wow.
It's kind of funny because there's sort of a bifurcation at one point, kind of in the 60s, between very traditional festivals where you tend not to find any drinking, certainly not any drug use, and these other festivals that are very much kind of countercultural. And you start getting these folks from New York or Boston and all these Northeastern colleges and universities with long hair and beards, people who look like Jerry Garcia or David Grisman coming in. And this becomes another sort of avenue of bluegrass in the U.S. And that's the festival, in fact, or that's kind of the festival culture that a lot of these Japanese folks like Bluegrass 45 experience.
You know, I never thought about this before, but because you just said it, Bill Monroe and Earl Scruggs and Lester Flatts must have been just total. I can't imagine what their response was when they realized their music was beginning to be embraced by these druggies in the Northeast.
It's a really weird phenomenon, and you see them responding in different ways to it. That's absolutely right. And Bill Monroe makes points. It actually becomes kind of a point of pride for him when he's got Northerners picking the banjo, like Bill Keith famously in the Bluegrass Boys. And he makes a point of saying he's from the North. He's a Yankee, but he sure can pick the banjo pretty good.
Well, he also points out, yes, he's got a Jewish player in the band who he's always proud to point to, right?
That's right, in a way that we would find kind of problematic now, right? You don't come out on the stage and saying, hey, by the way,
listen to that Jew boy play.
We've got ourselves a Jew. How about that?
After we take a break, Dennis Gainty will be back to share more of the music from some of his favorite Japanese bluegrass bands. This is Two Way Street.
And the steam. bluegrass all a-call. What a good place to be born.
Welcome back to Two-Way Street. I'm Bill Nigut. If you're just joining us, my guest today is Dennis Gainty. He teaches history at Georgia State University, but his passion is bluegrass music. And he's now researching and writing a book about how bluegrass caught on 7,000 miles and an ocean away from the Appalachian Mountains where it was born and took root in Japan. You write that when you attend a club or a festival in Japan, an American, you put a stamp of credibility on it that is really striking to you, right?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And it couldn't be more horribly ironic because inevitably these Japanese guys know so much more about bluegrass than I do. And I don't know how many times I've been at a bluegrass festival or a party or some club, and folks will call out a classic Bill Monroe tune and look at me expectantly, and I'll say, I'm sorry, what key is that in? And they'll say, oh, it's the key that he played it in on the B-side of his 1958 single, Go. And I'll say, oh, yeah, I'm really sorry. I'm not sure if I know that one. And so the idea that I would be coming from my, you know, really kind of patchy background of having gotten bluegrass the same way a lot of northerners or a lot of, you know, city billies did, right? Through Newgrass or through like Olden and the Way, these hippie groups. The fact that I represent any kind of authenticity is what's so interesting about this. Because in some ways, it's not about how good the music sounds. It's about the kind of image that's generated for them when they're hearing it or when they're performing it or when they're seeing somebody from one culture or the other doing it.
You have sent us some other bands that you obviously really like. And one of them is the Nakashima Family Band. You say they're no longer active, but one of the reasons they're not mostly all girl band, but one of the most interesting things about them, and we're going to listen to them in a second, is you talk about the fact their father wanted his children to learn bluegrass music.
This is a really interesting overlay of a very Japanese traditional patriarchal kind of model. And especially so because these guys are from Kyushu, which is this island, not the main island of Japan, Honshu, but Kyushu is the site of lots of really traditional proud samurai culture. And in fact, Kyushu is where the rebellion came from that toppled the shogunate and set up the emperor in 1868. There's all kinds of really rich history there. And this really, by all accounts, fairly authoritarian dad in this family was making sure that they didn't go out and play with their friends, that they didn't go and have fun in any other way, that they practiced their bluegrass. And for this family of girls growing up, this is just the worst ever.
Let's listen to the Nakashima Family Band. Things that I find kind of interesting about that, Dennis, is we're a little bit more used to hearing female voices when we hear traditional Japanese music than male voices.
Yeah, I mean, there's kind of, you know, obviously there's a wide range of traditional Japanese music, but there's no doubt that the idea of a female singing voice is something that certainly Americans might think of, and especially that connection with geisha or with that sort of.
And we sort of hear that. When we hear these women singing, we're the tenor of their voices, the pitch of their voices, we can just as easily hear those women singing traditional Japanese songs, and yet now they've turned their attention to the bluegrass. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah. I think that's totally reasonable. And it's again, kind of all about our ears as Americans and sort of what we're thinking about and what we're expecting.
You also sent to us a couple of examples of more recent bluegrass music. And I really want to, before we finish up, listen to a little of it because I think it's wonderful. You talk about a young mandolin player, Taro Inoue?
That's right. That's right. So Taro is the son of Inoue Saburo, one of the members, the banjo player in Bluegrass 45. And he's one of the founders of this very long-running bluegrass festival. So in a way, also, you have this sense of a legacy of families that are kind of reproducing
themselves. Let's listen to a little of Taro Inoue.
He's kind of part of this, it's not even exactly new grass because that's kind of a 1980s movement in American music. It's something kind of new that's developing out of bluegrass.
You also shared with us, you call them a young hip group, the Bluegrass Police. Tell us about them.
They're pretty wonderful. I first ran into them at a club called Rocky Top in Ginza in Tokyo. And Rocky Top, like a lot of Japanese clubs, is, my gosh, it's like maybe 15 feet by 10 feet. And they pack as many people in there as they can. It's on the fourth floor of some nondescript office building. And it's just full of bluegrass paraphernalia. And when I saw them, they were really impressive, not just in terms of their musicianship, which is absolutely top notch, but also their energy. At some point during every show, the banjo player takes off his shirt, at least. The whole thing gets really pretty crazy, but it's a lot of fun. And they're a big favorite with, if anybody's kind of representing the sort of young current wave of bluegrass in Japan, I would say it's them.
Let's listen to the Bluegrass Police. Bluegrass Police. Dennis, as we come to an end of the show, this is all fun, and you have learned and brought us a lot of great information about how bluegrass music has moved across the ocean to Japan. But you put it in a larger context for us, I think, in an essay that you wrote, and it becomes more than just a matter of people loving similar music. You say this: as a historian of modern Japan, I've come to realize that the story of bluegrass music in Japan touches on fundamental questions of what it means to be a human being in the modern world, how we all use the big experiences of tradition and newness of the familiar and the foreign to create our own identities. Talk about that.
One thing that you run into a lot in the case of Japan is the notion that the Japanese imitate. And this has been going on literally for millennia, that the Japanese appropriated Chinese language and Chinese architecture, and they got Buddhism through Korea, and they got lots of anatomy and science from the Dutch, and they got baseball and various parts of the educational system from the Americans, and the Constitution from the Prussians. And it just goes on and on and on, all the way through Elvis and transistors and goodness knows what. And this is something that the Japanese will say as well. And this, I think, to me, is kind of troubling, because ultimately it sort of denies the creativity, and I think it's not wrong to say the soul, of these human beings who are bringing their own experience to embracing these ideas. And it also blinds us to the way that we as Americans imitate. I mean, for goodness sakes, we don't even speak our own language. We don't call it American-ish, right? But the notion that somehow what the Japanese do with other cultures is kind of a different act, is not quite as real or not quite as authentic, is something really important that we can kind of break down here. Because I think what we see with bluegrass is that this idea of a tradition, we understand, is not really as old as we think it is. And it's not really the story that we tell ourselves about it. But using that story, we're able to kind of move forward and create a kind of common bond. And we as Americans have done that. We've kind of put the label of American onto it. But if you look at the story carefully, you'll see that bluegrass doesn't really move from America to Japan as much as it moves from Appalachia simultaneously to this kind of global, maybe proto-hipster kind of college-educated elite community that stretches all over the planet. So from New York to Tokyo, everybody simultaneously, really in the late 50s, understanding that bluegrass is this kind of wonderfully pure, local, traditional, authentic human thing. And we can all take it and hear something important in it and reproduce it and enjoy it for ourselves. And I think if we stop thinking quite so much about the we're Americans and they're Japanese, and instead think more about how we're all kind of taking elements of culture from one place and sort of transforming it into something meaningful to ourselves and our families and our friends and our communities, I think we'll be a little better off.
I can't think of any words I can add to that wonderful way of closing out this edition of Two-Way Street. Dennis, thank you so much for being here. Is there any chance you have a single favorite bluegrass song that you'd like us to play going out, or one of your favorites?
Here's a great one. There's a lovely song, it's Newgrass, but it's by a group called Newgrass Revival, the super group from the 1970s and 1980s. And the song is called Sapporo, which is, of course, the capital of the prefecture of Hokkaido, the northernmost island.
We will play that song as we say goodbye. And again, thanks so much for being here today.
Thank you so much. This was really wonderful.
Dennis Gainty is an associate professor of history at Georgia State University. He's also an expert on the bluegrass music movement in Japan. He's writing a book about Japanese bluegrass. As Dennis requested, here's Sapporo, which was an extended jam that Newgrass Revival often played in their concerts back in the 1970s and 80s. The banjo player you'll hear on this recording was Bela Fleck, who many of you know went on to become the leader of a popular progressive roots band, Bela Fleck, who many of you may know went on to become the leader of a popular progressive roots band, Bela Fleck and the Flecktones. We have a lot more content about Japanese bluegrass on the Two-Way Street website. You can find videos of some of the bluegrass bands that Dennis and I discussed on today's show. Just go to gpb.org/TWS. Before we leave you today, I wanted to share with you a really fun audio essay. Our own Jenny Ammon competed against audio producers from all over the world recently in KCRW's annual 24-hour radio race. The race is one long day of high-stakes radio making. Participants are given a theme early in the day and have 24 hours to write, record, and edit a nonfiction story. The theme this year, Out of Range. Did they sleep? Nope. But they did manage to put together this piece, a profile of Trudy Nan Boyce, a retired lieutenant with the Atlanta Police Department who was a senior crisis negotiator during her career.
Tell me what happened today that brought you here. I want to make you feel safe. I'm going to stand here. I won't come any closer. Nobody's going to come any closer until we figure this out. you have a say in how this is going to go. If I can get in range, conversational range. And then you can't hear. You can't hear. Sounds of war, sounds of combat, sounds of crisis.
Ma'am. Ma'am, talk to me, please.
I'm Trudy Nan Boyce, and I'm a retired lieutenant with the Atlanta Police Department and was a senior hostage negotiator. The better name for that is a crisis negotiator. I had a man on the steps of the Capitol who had a shotgun duct taped to his body so that the barrel came up under his chin so that if he pulled the trigger, it would kill him. So he wanted the press to see how unfair the court system was to fathers. I took time and I wrote it down, what his complaints were. Everybody wants to be listened to. And he gave himself up, laid down, and we were able to take him into custody. You tell me what's going to work for you to make the situation better. There have been a few times when I couldn't get it within range in order to negotiate with somebody. In the case of the Vietnam vet, he was firing a high-powered rifle at the armored vehicle while we were approaching. I was never able to establish contact with him. We just couldn't get close enough. If you can get close enough to establish some kind of communications, we use megaphones. The cars have mics on them, so we're using that and also just using a loud voice, too. He could hear us.
Sandy, are you there? Sandy, are you there?
Of course, there are limits to things we can do. People will often say, well, I want to talk to my wife or I want to talk to my mother or my father. We can't do that. The reason for that is perhaps the issue has to do with the wife or the father, and the minute they talk to that person, they will go ahead and complete the act of suicide. So I was involved in a negotiation where we had somebody who was a friend, and he made contact and said, you know, you need to be a man and come on and help us out here. Give yourself up. And he said, I'll show you what a man does. This is how you man up. And he killed himself. He shot himself. Your child can hurt you. Your partner can hurt you. Your parent can hurt you. They can say the thing that sends you into an emotional meltdown. Because it's only those people that we care about that are close enough to us that can really do the emotional damage. This is between you and me. You and I still have some say in how this is going to go. And I'm going to listen to you, and we'll find out how we can work this out again. So we're a team now. Step over the railing, put the weapon down, step back through the window. It feels good.
Try to see it my way. Do I have to keep on talking till I can go on? While you see it your way, run the risk of knowing that our love may soon be gone. We can work it out.
That was This Is Between You and Me from Two-Way Street senior producer Jenny Ament, digital producer Ezra Morris, and Clara Nibley. They profiled Trudy Nan Boyce, a retired lieutenant with the Atlanta Police Department who was a senior crisis negotiator during her career.
Life is very short and there's no time for fussing and fighting, my friend. Thought that it's a crime, so I will ask you once again.
That's it for this week's Two-Way Street. Our senior producer is the really remarkable Jenny Ament. Our interns are Robert Jimison and James Rising. I'm Bill Nygut. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you again next week for another Two-Way Street.
Life is very short, and there's no time for fussing and fighting, my friend. I have always thought that it's a crime, so I will ask you once again. Try to see it my way, only time will tell if I